All right. Well, welcome to Heartland History, the official podcast of the Midwestern History Association. I am one of the co-hosts, Camden Bird, current professor at Eastern Illinois University. And I am with Ramya Swayamprakash. Ramya, who are you and how are you?
Who is an existential question? How is fairly good because my kid is now playing cricket. So I guess a South Asian parent in me is
love it.
Happy.
Love it. I told you in Charleston, there's a pickup cricket game in the park in downtown Charleston, Illinois. And I always want to walk over and see if they'll let me play. But I just genuinely don't know the rules. And I would make an ass of myself.
If there's anything South Asians can teach you is that you don't need to know the rules of cricket. There are no rules when you start playing.
I love it. Well, you're currently in Grand Rapids, Michigan, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Where we will be together, right, in a few weeks. I guess we should note, right, just a reminder, the Midwestern History Conference is coming up. And,
yes. You
know, all the listeners are already making their plans, so they'll be there.
Yeah, come listen to us. Come hang out with us.
Yes. And the plenary is announced. Former guest on the pod will be giving the plenary's talk at that event, and that's Delia Fernandez-Jones, who I believe will be talking a little bit more about her research in Grand Rapids. So it's a geographically makes sense, and will be a great talk as well.
Yes, it will. And she was actually on the Stateside podcast yesterday. Or today.
Oh, really? Oh, I'll have to check that out. Today, what are we doing today?
Yeah, today we're going to be talking about When a Dream Dies, Agriculture, Iowa, and the Farm Crisis of the 1980s, which is written by Dr. Pamela Riney-Kerberg, who is a distinguished professor of history at Iowa State University, and she's taught there since the fall of 2000. She's an adopted Midwesterner. Maybe I should call myself. Having spent most of her life here in the Midwest since 1985, starting in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. Her research and teaching focus on the history of families and communities in the rural Midwest. And we met with her to talk about her recent book, which was published by the University of Kansas Press.
Yeah, it was a great conversation, and Pam's been on this pod before, but it was really great to talk about this new book. Any sort of takeaways that you think people should be looking out for as they start this podcast?
Two things. One is, you know, I say this enough in the pod itself, but the writing, because it's really evocative, and it's really a great primer on how to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second is just sort of paying attention to the long through lines that she weaves in terms of where the farm crisis comes from, and especially what the future might look like, right, if we don't pay attention to these crises. especially, you know, because we're looking at a future in the Midwest where there's going to be far more migration, you know, as human-induced climate change means that people need to move north. It's going to become a thing. So, like, our entire spatial imagination of the Midwest is about to be totally changed. So, yeah, I think reading this book will help people think through all of those things as well.
You know, the farm crisis is a huge historical moment that I think has largely been forgotten in popular consciousness. And I think Pam's book does a great job of recovering that history. It's also a call to continue to recover those histories. And I think what it also does is it helps to dispel a certain popular mythology that's often painted on the rural Midwest of sort of stoicism, of peace, of harmony, a certain pastoral, idyllic society. And I think, you know, there's harm in painting that picture onto those places because it erases reality, but also can cover up genuine hardship, right? And genuine experiences in those spaces. And for that reason, I think this book is really important, but also the call to continue research on rural spaces and modern rural history as well of the Midwest. And I think this book is a great way to start that conversation.
Yeah. I think, you know, just when you were talking, I was thinking of how the Midwest is often painted as being flat, you know, culturally, historically, all of those things. But I think I cannot say enough about how this book does a phenomenal job of not just disrupting that sort of flatness narrative, but bringing the specificity of Iowa into like in sharp focus, right? Mm-hmm. And it sort of creates a way for other places in the Midwest to sort of talk about these things so we can learn more comparatively. Right. So it's specific without necessarily being prescriptive, but it's specific in ways that sort of opens up lines of inquiry. And my God, it's beautifully written. So yes.
Kudos. Well, I think that does it. Should we start the podcast?
Let's go.
Well, Pam, welcome back to Heartland History. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and we're here talking about your most recent book. And maybe before we jump into the meat of the book, you could spend a bit of time telling us the backstory to this project. What got you interested in the history of the farm crisis in Iowa?
I had to come at this very gradually. I was in graduate school when the farm crisis was at its worst. And I can't say that I was as aware of what was happening as I should have been. When you're a graduate student, you're much more concerned about other things than what's going on out in farm country. But I was aware, you know, that something really serious had happened. But because it happened, you know, when it did in the 1980s, it took a long time for me to actually think of it as history rather than current events. But I got hired in 2000 to teach at Iowa State University. And one of my most important jobs was working with graduate students. And those graduate students kept asking me, why hasn't someone written a history of the farm crisis? And I kept saying, well, it really wasn't that long ago. You know, historians take a while to come around to these things. And then it got to be about 10 years ago, and I was thinking about doing some work on small towns in Iowa, and I realized that there was no way I could talk about what had happened in small, what was happening in small town Iowa without understanding the farm crisis, but there really wasn't anything new out there about the farm crisis. And so finally came to the conclusion that I had to do this. And Iowa, of course, is self-explanatory because I live here in Iowa. And Iowa also made a really good container for talking about the farm crisis because the farm crisis really smacked the upper Midwest hard. Iowa was in the middle of that. Iowa had a very activist governor for the farm crisis. And so the amount of material here all by itself was absolutely enormous. And so, you know, containing the project to Iowa once I decided to do it was a bit of a no-brainer. But, you know, it was a combination of people asking me, why hasn't this been done? And my realization that if you want to understand the small town Midwest, how it looks today, you have to go back to the 1980s and look at what happened to farms and to communities during those years, or else you're not going to understand what's going on today.
And so you open with a chapter titled The Go-Go 70s, and in it, you're sort of setting up the conditions that will lead to the farm crisis at the tail end of the decade. But as you note, the changes in agriculture were far-reaching and lacked a single actor who could be blamed. You write, farmers, scientists, inventors, bureaucrats, and others planted the seeds of the farm crisis in the 1970s and earlier. For the listeners, perhaps you could unpack that a bit. What had changed in agriculture that would lay the groundwork for crises?
There was a whole lot going on that led to this enormous problem in the 80s. Probably the most, well, the deepest rooted problem was overproduction. The United States, basically since 1900, has been able to produce far more than the citizens of the United States can eat and far more than we can export. And there were, we've had varying responses to that, but the biggest response has been farmers trying to produce more so that they can make up for the low prices caused by overproduction, and that leads to even more overproduction. Lots of fuel gets added to this fire in the 1970s. Part of that fuel is government policy. The United States had as its Secretary of Agriculture in the 1970s a man named Earl Butz. And Earl Butz was well known for having told farmers to get big or get out, and that they should be planting from fence row to fence row. And not all farmers, but many farmers took that to heart. Now, part of what Butz was trying to do was to generate more of a surplus so that the United States could sell to the Soviet Union. In the 1970s, politicians in Washington decided that it was time to be business partners and to take advantage of all of this by selling lots of grain to the USSR. And for a short while, that added to farmers' incomes significantly, and it absorbed a whole lot of this overproduction because the United States was producing well and the Soviet Union was in the middle of a number of droughts and basically disastrous harvests. And so there's that issue going on. There is also, because of how farmers are expanding and because of how much they're selling to the Soviet Union, we also get soaring land prices. And prices for land in the upper Midwest more than double during the 1970s. Now, at the same time as the price of land is more than doubling, interest rates were very low. And so for farmers who are in that situation, they looked at the fact that interest rates were low. They looked at the fact that there were good markets for what they were producing. And they went out and they spent money. They borrowed against the value of that land, often with variable rate borrowing, which meant that if interest rates soared, that they were going to be facing difficulty. And then two things happened. One of those was that the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and President Carter decided that it was time for an embargo, a grain embargo against the Soviet Union. And so at least temporarily, there was a decrease in the market for American grain, although this is made up over time. But more importantly, people in Washington get worried about inflation. And one of the ways to fight inflation is to increase interest rates. And so we have all of these Midwestern farmers who have taken out these loans to improve the size of their farms, to buy more equipment. And all of a sudden, they're facing interest rates that at times went almost to 25%. Oh. And they were incapable of absorbing, well, at least a lot of them were incapable of absorbing a blow like that. And by the middle of the decade, two-thirds of Iowa's farmers were in really serious economic trouble. Half of them roughly in imminent danger of losing their farms. And then another half, maybe not in imminent danger, but really worried and facing really significant economic distress.
You know, the 70s are a period of sort of volatile shifts in the economy, thinking about energy and whatnot. But, as you point out, right, 79 really is when this starts to be felt across agricultural communities. When does it feel like in Iowa that this is not just a blip? This is not just sort of a momentary pass or downturn. At what point are people starting to say like, oh, this is something bigger? This is a crisis,
right? Kind of depended on who you were.
Yeah.
If you were a small farmer who was in debt, you knew it in 1980 because you couldn't handle the interest rates mm-hmm. that you were seeing. For people who were perhaps in a little better economic condition, there they're seeing people failing around them, even if they're not failing. And I would say that the average Iowa farmer by 1982, 1983 really knows that this, even if they're not personally in trouble, they know people who are. Mm-hmm. And it's in these years that the suicide rate for farmers soars. And that gets the attention of a lot of people. But I would say for those who are in government, they're trying to decide what this thing is. Mm-hmm. They're trying to decide, is this a short-term correction or is this something much bigger? And it's going to be 1984 before people in government decide that, okay, we really have to do something. You know, they don't want to overstep. They don't want to take significant action if this is just going to be, you know, another one of those little blips that farmers go through. But by 1984, it's pretty clear that this is not a blip, mm-hmm. that this is a significant, far-reaching problem that is hitting, like I said, two-thirds of Iowa's farm households.
What really struck me, and I think is obvious, you know, it makes sense when you think about it, but given the context in that historical moment that you're talking about, right, this sort of early on, a lot of farmers are talking about, like, you know, like we got to sort of work to raise these prices for agricultural goods. But at the same time, you have this larger economic moment with rising interest rates, in which consumers, those who are sort of eating the food, right, domestically, don't want to see higher prices at the grocery store. So there is this sort of antagonism between consumers and farmers during this time period that puts, I'm guessing, a lot of those policymakers in a bind.
Oh, it does. The USDA in particular. Well, the USDA into 1984 is denying there's a problem.
Right.
But by the 1980s, they very clearly have multiple constituencies. They have farmers who they have to deal with, but they also have to deal with consumers. And there are, you know, in the 1970s, there were soaring grocery prices. And the average consumer didn't understand that there was a big difference between grocery prices and what farmers got from that grocery price. And the consumers are saying, hey, now, wait a minute, I'm having a hard time feeding my kids. I don't want to pay more for a loaf of bread. And farmers are saying, now, wait a minute, I only get 3 cents from that loaf. So the inflation problem is somewhere else. It's not in what I'm growing. It's in the processing. But, you know, your average consumer doesn't see that.
Right.
And so for, you know, for anybody looking on, I guess the question is then, what was the initial reaction of everyone who's looking on, right? So how did elected officials and economists, those great fiction writers, make sense of this downturn? what does it say? What does that say about how farmers and the farm economy were viewed during this period?
Well, it really took the people who were looking on, people who were entirely outside of agriculture, just looking on, quite a while to figure out all of this. And I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, outside of, well, the Midwest, the agriculture isn't at the center of people's concerns. Mm-hmm. We want to keep being fed, but how that food gets to us, And, you know, people, it took the economists a while to figure out, oh, this is a really serious downturn. This is big. It took the people in Extension. You know, Extension, they work with farmers all the time. But, you know, they're partially taking their cues from the USDA, but they're also, you know, sort of waiting and seeing, is this going to correct itself? By that time, a lot of people had lost their farms or were now so deeply in debt that they weren't going to be able to get out. I mean, what's also happening at the same time that I think a lot of people just weren't thinking about was that this incredible increase in interest rates caused land prices to tank. Land prices went up and up and up in the 70s, which is what made it possible for people to take all these loans. Mm-hmm. But once interest rates go up, all of a sudden you can get a better return on a CD or even your savings account than you can get on land. So nobody wants land. Wow. And if you look at how much land prices have dropped by 1985, 86 throughout Iowa, in every single county, it's between 60 and 67%. Wow. So all of these farmers have taken out all of these loans on land that is now worthless relative to their debts. Maybe not worthless, but it's lost an incredible amount of its value. And all of a sudden, they're upside down on their loans. And they can see that coming. The moment those land prices start to slide, they can see it coming. But everybody else is still kind of hanging back. And I think that really speaks to the fact that by the 1980s, farmers were 2% of our population in the United States as a whole. And most Americans, including those in Washington, just hadn't thought about what all of this was going to mean.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to, I mean, some of the stories that you pull out later, even of just sort of commentators in Washington noticing. We'll get to that in a later question. But, you know, there are people in Iowa, in the grassroots, right? There are several groups and organizations that do recognize, right, these deeper issues and are attempting to address farmers' needs. You talk about the efforts of several groups in Iowa, you know, this ranging from, you know, agricultural extension offices, to other groups such as Rural America or Catholic Rural Life. I was really interested in the history of Denise O'Brien and the Iowa Farm Unity Coalition, who worked hard as an activist to keep farmers on the farms, right? I mean, that was sort of the project there. What you illustrate is sort of divergent opinions of how to deal with the crisis, even among these different organizations, right? How did these organizations understand the crisis or seek to address the crisis? Where did they differ? And what do those divergent opinions reveal about the nature and the perception of the crisis in Iowa during this period?
Well, the Iowa Farm Unity Coalition is an umbrella organization that takes in a lot of left-leaning farm groups. And that includes like Catholic Rural Life. And the leaders of that organization, people like Denise O'Brien, Dixon Terry, are very much New Deal Democrats. And what they want to see is a return to New Deal type farm policy, which sought to address surpluses and to reduce surpluses to increase the incomes of farmers. They also were the very first to create a hotline for farmers in distress, which they ran as a volunteer operation. You had farmers who'd been through this, who had some knowledge of what resources were available, taking phone calls at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, midnight, talking to people who needed help entirely voluntarily. So that's happening at the grassroots. And those people are also, you know, going to Washington. They're going to Des Moines. They're going to Washington. They're arguing for, you know, a return to 1930s farm policy. Then you have the Farm Bureau, much more conservative, and they're lobbying as well. And they do eventually get to the point where they're talking about this as a significant crisis. But they represent larger farmers, older farmers. So they're not as much in the trenches on all of this. Extension is really interesting because they were slow to get into this whole problem really deeply, I think, because of the US, the lead that the USDA was taking, which was not very helpful. But there's a moment of realization in 1984 that this thing isn't going away, that they're going to have to get their program big or lots of people are going to end up losing their farms. And so they set up, and there's a whole contentious thing over this, but they set up their own hotline funded by the state. They begin going out to farms with computers, you know, big old hefty computers, and sitting down at people's living room tables, dining room tables, and working out with them where they were. Were they capable of saving their farm or not? And running the numbers for people. And I've actually seen the printout for Denise O'Brien's farm when they did this. They were well into negative income in the year that her family decided to have Extension sit down with them. Now, Extension is different from the Iowa Farm Unity Coalition, in that the Iowa Farm Unity Coalition is basically do anything you have to keep your farm. Extension, on the other hand, is basically, is this realistic? And then how do we provide a soft landing to people who have to get out, to people who are well into a negative income, who have hundreds, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt? How do we give them a soft landing? And Extension does something really interesting, which is this vast expansion into mental health. You don't expect that from Iowa, from the Iowa's Cooperative Extension Service. They're not trained in that. That's not their traditional role. But they're going to people's kitchen tables, figuring out what's happening to them. And they're dealing with weeping people who are desperate, who are sometimes calling them in the middle of the night saying, I think I'm going to kill myself. And so they have to think about mental health. And they train people to work with farmers on mental health issues. They fund mental health programs through existing clinics throughout the state. They really get into mental health. And they also encourage farmers to help themselves. They help them create groups that come together to talk about their problems, to help each other. And so there is a really, I mean, it's a big response. It would have been better if it wasn't so delayed. But you can see all of this happening on the ground with, you know, farmer-created groups trying to help, with government-created groups trying to help, and the people who are Iowa's representatives also really, you know, maybe not always advocating the same solutions, but speaking with one voice and saying, these are problems that have to be fixed. And I never really expected, you know, maybe because I'm so steeped in, you know, 21st century political culture now, but you could see the governor, Terry Branstad, who is a Republican, working very closely, of course, with Charles Grassley, who was also one of Iowa's senators, but also Tom Harkin, who was a Democratic senator. And they're all speaking with one voice, saying, this is a problem that has to be solved. This is not the farmer's fault. This is a systemic problem. And we need to do something about this. And I found it really remarkable that these three men who are so very different were working so very closely to try and resolve a statewide problem.
You know, the research in this book is really incredible. And of course, for listeners, they should obviously, I mean, they've already bought it, but they should buy another copy. It makes for a great gift, obviously, right? But, you know, you blend these larger political histories with these really intimate portraits of farm families during the 1980s, which certainly reflects, you know, your past research in research interests in family and gender history. As you note, the crisis shaped families in different ways, but perhaps you could share some examples from your research, because I, you know, it's hard to demonstrate this over a podcast, but just like what is really moves you in this story is all these sort of individual stories that you poke up. I was particularly drawn to your use of yearbooks to get at sort of the perspective of adolescents and children who are working through this crisis. And so, yeah, I'm just, you know, what was that process like for you? What stood out to you? How is this being felt sort of in the home?
That yearbook, I'm going to start with the yearbook because it is my favorite piece of evidence I found in all of my research. I was over in Harlan working in the Shelby County Historical Society, and the man who was the director brought over the stack of yearbooks, and he said, maybe you'll find something in here. And I started going down through the stack, and you know, the first few of them were really standard yearbooks, maybe a little mention here and there that there was something going on nothing really big until I get to the middle of the stack. And there's the cover, which is a bunch of colored pencils in a stack. And at the bottom of it, it says something's missing. And I thought, holy crow, you know, what could this be about? This is not your standard cover. I mean, all the others are themes that have to do with rock and roll and sports and all that sort of stuff. And I open it up and I almost started crying because I immediately recognized that this yearbook was about the farm crisis. And you turn page by page and it's teenagers talking about their fears for their community. And I managed to track down the woman who had been the editor of that yearbook. And she told us, yeah, you know, we were selected to be on the yearbook, but there's this horrible thing going on. And we wanted to represent the experience of the whole community in our yearbook. We wanted to tell people what was going on because this isn't going to be a yearbook about what a great football team Harlan always has. This is going to be a yearbook about how hard this is. And they got some help from the Iowa Writers Workshop, which used to do, I don't know if they still do, a yearbook editors workshop during the summer. So they thought about it, they came back, and even the portrait pages tell a story about the farm crisis because they have, you know, a little box there next to some of the seniors that says seniors going, going, gone. And they talk about how all the seniors are planning on leaving town. This woman who was the yearbook editor also left town and never, essentially, except for weddings, funerals, and Christmas, never went back. And I was really struck by this story of young people who didn't know where they were going to go or what they were going to do in this town of 5,000 people, where there were 150 houses for sale and nobody was buying because the crisis was gutting their town. I also had the great good fortune of being the first historian into Terry Branstad's papers. They had been accumulating over the course of his many terms as governor, and they finally transferred them to the State Historical Society. And they let me in, even though they hadn't been processed, to look at what was in there. And the most important sources for me were the correspondence files. And you had ordinary Iowans, you know, some of them little kids, some of them in their 80s, you know, everybody in between writing in about their experience of the farm crisis. And they're amazing. There was one that was an auction flyer sent by the family that was losing that farm. And the wife had written quite a bit about how hard this was for them. But the really heartbreaking part of it was you flipped it over and their little children had written on the flyer as well. And I don't know if it was a little boy or girl had written, "Dear Governor Branstad, please help my parents so they can be happy again." This is a little tiny child, early grade school, asking the governor to help her parents, his parents, so they can be happy again. And that's, you know, that's really heartbreaking. Another woman sent in the 20-page diary she'd been keeping of all of their interactions with their lender and all of the times that they had canceled their appointments with them and all of the times they had refused to show them their own file, just page after page of this family banging their heads against the wall, trying to get help. Other families writing in, and it's almost always the women, writing in and saying, "This is killing my children. They are struggling. They are doing everything that they can to try and help us get out of this situation, but there's nothing they can do, and there's nothing. We have done everything. We haven't spent money we didn't have. We haven't been extravagant. The five of us are living in four rooms, and we still can't make ends meet." And there are these gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching letters from people who are in the middle of this moment and they don't know what to do. I call them 4 o'clock in the morning letters. Mm. Because you can tell that it's 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, there's tear stains on the paper. And the person whose handwriting had been pretty normal at the beginning has gotten to the point where the letters are 5 inches tall. And they're saying, help, help, help the farmers. You know, they're at the end of their rope. Mm-hmm. Another letter in there, someone who was almost literally at the end of his rope, saying, I've tried this, I've tried that, I've done everything. And what I'm going to do next is climb up on top of the corn crib, and I'm going to tie a rope to the corn crib. I'm going to put the other end around my neck. And when they come to take my farm, I'm going to jump. And then he wrote a month later when nothing has gotten any better. And he said, this time, instead of threatening to kill himself, he said, I'm going to be on top of the grain bin with my rifle the next time they try and come and take my farm. Wow. So you could see just the intensity of the feeling and the intensity of the heartbreak that these people were experiencing. And these letters, they were horrible to read. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they were way harder to write. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you really feel what these people were experiencing in some small way. You can feel what they were feeling when they wrote that letter and said, I'm at the end of my rope.
You know, when I was reading this book, so when I was growing up in India, there was this one book that a lot of us read. It was called Everybody Loves a Good Drought. And the book was about India's farm crisis, which, you know, has reverberations in terms of land losing value, farmers not having money and sort of killing themselves for loans that were as little as 50,000 rupees, which is about $600, $800. But the value of their land had lost was so sort of beyond what they could repay because it had just degraded so much that they didn't have any recourse. And, you know, and a few of them were literate, and a lot of their sort of letters, or their sort of suicide notes, sound like the kinds of things that you had to read. And as you were talking, I was just thinking about how, you know, the voices of these people and how they get lost. And just to sort of echo what Camden was saying earlier, what really struck me about your book was sort of the ways in which you bring these voices to the fore, right? Like that's what makes us rereading sections last night. And I was like, this is what I really like about this book, that you bring in these individual voices. And this is just my ignorance. I have only flown over Iowa. I've never been to Iowa. And so, you know, I grew up in India. So Iowa is just like a part of the blob for me when I was growing up. But what really struck me about your book was sort of one, thinking about my own life back in India, but also just the ways in which you're able to bring out these stories. So I just wanted to say thank you and congratulations. Back to the podcast. You know, the realities facing farm families reverberated through their communities. And you talked a little about this earlier. Alongside the farm crisis, you note a broader collapse of small towns throughout Iowa. How did the ongoing farm crisis shape the economy, social life, and structure in small towns across the state?
Small towns had a heck of a time during the farm crisis because, of course, they are were so dependent on the farm economy. Farmers did business in town. Farmers sent their children to school in town. Farmers went to church in town. And all of a sudden, the money isn't there, and the people... Well, people are losing their farms, they're leaving, and small towns really suffer. And where you see it in particular is in a loss of institutions. There are so many things that small towns need in order to stay viable, and they lose their hospitals, they lose their doctors, they lose their schools. And the schools are the loss that they're the most worried about, because they make the assumption, and it's at least partially true, that If the school goes, the town goes. If there is no place for people to send children to school within, you know, a fairly tight radius, that community is going to die. And that's not been totally borne out in, you know, the 40 years since. But it does, you know, these schools, these communities take an enormous hit when their schools disappear. And for young people in particular, losing a school is a really terrible thing. And a lot of these communities shrink drastically. They lose all these institutions. They lose their grocery stores. And they lose a lot of their capability to hold the people that they have. And so this is part of an ongoing downward decline in the number of really viable small towns in Iowa.
I spend a lot of time in rural Illinois, especially on Tuesdays. I teach at a correctional facility, and I spent in leaving there. There's no like quick route back to sort of the major highway from there. So I spend about 90 minutes on like real local roads in Illinois, rural Illinois, and to still see the evidences of those communities almost as you can see what they once were. I mean, I'm thinking of towns you drive through where they have sort of like a block or two blocks of storefronts. And not an exaggeration. I mean, there's not one of them that has something in it today, right? Places that probably were old restaurants or old community gathering spaces, post offices, grocers, whatever. But just sort of connecting that. And maybe it just was more pronounced as I was reading your book over the past few weeks that I was just like, oh my God, you just sort of start to see more of this evidence of this sort of community downsizing that happens. I mean, it had been happening, but definitely sped up during the 1980s and it continues to happen to a degree, but you hear about sort of the long decline of rural America, but we often, and I think what is important about taking the farm crisis seriously is there are economic moments, there are decisions, there are these moments that, history happens and has ramifications that we can still see today. Right.
Well, you have to get off the main roads. I think that it is incredibly important that everybody who lives here in the Midwest or everybody who visits the Midwest gets off the main roads. What you see from I-80 and what you see from US 69 are very different. And take it one step further and get onto those county roads, and you see the farms. You know, we drive back and forth from Des Moines, a suburb of Des Moines, every week. And I see all of these empty houses. And there's one of them in particular that we drive by just about every week. And it's a lovely two-story home. It's still got all its windows. It had to have been somebody's much beloved home, built probably around 1900. And it just makes me sad that there is nobody there. And that's something that is increasingly happening all over the upper Midwest. There's something called a last generation farmer. And a last generation farmer is a person who, when they retire, is not going to have anybody in their family to whom they could hand down that farm as an operator. Someone in their family is going to inherit that farm, but more than likely, nobody in their family is ever going to farm it again. And, you know, I don't blame the kids for not wanting to inherit that farm. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of uncertainty. But at the same time, it just breaks my heart that these places that people used to call home are now abandoned. And, you know, sitting there just waiting for time and the next windstorm to take them down.
Throughout the book, you provide moments when it seems like the broader American public, you know, either doesn't really understand what's going on with the farm crisis, or there's no real sense that there's sort of a real gravity to the situation. This is, you know, just the general public, but also at times like political and financial elites seem to be expressing this, right? You quote this offhand joke that President Reagan made in 1985 when he said, quote, "I think we should keep the grain and export the farmers." This of course did not land well among farmers. And although Reagan faced plenty of criticism, it was actually David Stockman, the director of Office of management and budget under Reagan, who seemed to be the target of the most criticism. Personally, as I was reading, I was struck by this image that you have, right, which is taken at this National Crisis Action Rally held in Ames, Iowa, where, you know, it's not clear if it's like an individual or a group, but attendees had hung an effigy of Stockman in that at that rally. I mean, was this? I mean, that's a pretty graphic image, but what does that say about the way many farmers felt about elected officials and how they were dealing with the crisis?
Yeah, Stockman was nobody's favorite in farm country because he basically said over his dead body, was President Reagan going to do something to address the farm crisis, basically. Now, over his dead body, was there going to be any kind of debt adjustment? Over his dead body, were there going to be increases in subsidies for farmers? And the farmers were, of course, livid. But also, you know, Governor Branstad had a very rancorous discussion with Stockman, at which he picked up a chair and slammed it down on the floor and, you know, had his say. But Stockman said no. I mean, the governor came back and told this, there was a huge assembly of people at the State of the State address, and the whole gallery was full of farmers and activists all holding white crosses silently as a witness to what was happening on their farms. And the governor said, well, we've been to Washington, we've talked to David Stockman, we've talked to President Reagan. And then he starts talking about, you know, what the state is going to try and do. But what he didn't tell everybody was that nobody in Washington listened. I think that at that moment, it would have been too disheartening. But nobody in Washington listened. And Reagan was very unpopular with large segments of the farming community in Iowa. Stockman did not have a single fan. There was a great feeling of having been abandoned and sort of a gut punch feeling that they'd been abandoned and things weren't going to get better.
I mean, there are these moments in which sort of the popular culture is, I don't know, like flirting with the idea or at least aware of the idea. You know, I think way back when we did an earlier podcast, we had briefly talked about, you know, the movie Country, Dorothy Lange. I mean, which was certainly drawing attention to this issue. And also Farm Aid. Was it 1985 Farm Aid? Yeah. Which, I mean, great lineup at Farm Aid. So there are these moments in which the sort of popular culture is is paying attention. But even Farm Aid doesn't raise a ton of money.
Country was a critical success, but a box office flop. And you watch it and you can understand why. Because it is so depressing.
Country is the story of a family today, willing to fight the government to hold onto everything they love.
Your dad and me, we're caught in the middle of something that we didn't even see coming.
You telling me to foreclose these people out?
We need to cut our losses, get what we can.
Willing to fight for their land, their family, their future, and each other.
And even though it ends with a tiny bit of hope that that the Farmers Home Association has been told to stop foreclosures, it's still this incredibly, incredibly true to life and incredibly depressing movie. And the reason why it was so true to life was that rural America, which becomes Prairie Fire, provided the financials, provided the basic economic information they needed to make that film. And so it's very realistic, but it doesn't get the box office that everybody wanted it to because it's a really depressing movie. Now, what gets more attention is the Farm Aid concerts and, you know, songs like John Mellencamp's Rain on the Scarecrow, Blood on the Plow.
Rain on the Scarecrow, Blood on the Plow, this land for the nation, this land made me proud. Son, I'm just sorry there's no legacy for you now. Rain on the Scarecrow, Blood on the Plow. Rain on the Scarecrow, Blood on the Plow.
Very popular. But I'm not sure people always made the connection between that song and something real. in spite of the video, which starts with, you know, young farm guys standing around and talking about, you know, what's happening on their farms. So if you watched MTV, you got a little bit of a lesson on the farm crisis. But, you know, the Farm Aid concerts were vastly misunderstood. Farmers thought that the money was going to be raised and they were going to be out of debt. Well, there's no way. They didn't raise anywhere near as much money as they thought they would. And there is no way that that money is going to do more than provide for legal advice and for some youth programming and for money for food pantries. And actually, a lot of food pantry money gets funneled into Iowa. Some activists at the time argued that what was most important about Farm Aid was that it made it possible for people to talk about the farm crisis. It made it possible for lots of people who otherwise were too ashamed, too deep in their own sorrows, to see what was going on around them, to actually talk about it. This was a time when it was considered really shameful to be in this kind of economic distress, and people needed permission. And so there are all sorts of people who otherwise would not have asked for help, who actually called a hotline during the concert and got help from someone, if only, you know, a name of a lawyer or information about where the nearest food bank was. You know, the popular culture does provide some clues to what's going on, but unfortunately not quite. Well, and, you know, you would think more people would have figured this out. It's on the front page of Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report. It's on the front page of the New York Times. You're hearing it on the radio, but still it doesn't soak in that this is a real crisis happening to ordinary people just like yourself who live, you know, 200 miles down the road.
By the later parts of the 1980s, the crisis seemed to be coming to a close. Land prices were starting to increase, crop and livestock prices were too. But there isn't necessarily a sense of overwhelming optimism. The pain from the crisis had left a lingering trauma in many Iowa communities. You write that the gloom that lingered more than likely had something to do with the continuing perception, and for many, reality, that the crisis was not over. How did farming in the late 1980s and 1990s solidify this feeling that even if the formal crisis was over, that something had demonstrably changed?
Yep. Nothing's ever going to be the same in farm country. There was a loss of farms. And by the end of the decade, Iowa has about 25% fewer farms than it had at the beginning of the decade. Nationwide, 15% of farms are lost during the decade. In the upper Midwest, it's 25% and north. So a lot of farm losses. But it also means that the people who wrote it out are now larger farmers. So, you know, the ones who ride it out, the ones who have a little bit of money, buy up their neighbors. And so fewer farmers, larger farms. It also changes how people farm. Going into all of this, the average Iowa farmer not only had corn and beans, but hogs and cattle, and sometimes chickens. They were not diversified in the sense that they would have been in 1900, but they were still relatively diverse farms. As a result of the crisis, there's a lot of people who simply get rid of their animals. It's one thing if you don't have enough resources to get your corn crop out of the field. It's another thing if you can't feed your cattle and they're starving. And so a lot of people get rid of their animals, and the people who remain raising animals are generally much larger livestock producers than had existed at the beginning of the crisis. So there's the growth of large livestock operations. There's the shift of most people out of livestock into just corn and beans. What there also is the loss of a whole generation of farmers. I've had extension people tell me that you're more likely to find a 40-year-old farmer today in Iowa than a 60-year-old farmer, because the 60-year-olds who would have been young adults in the middle of the crisis, they lost farms, or their father lost the farm they were supposed to inherit, or they looked at the situation and said, I'm not going to do that. I am not going to do that to myself. I'm not going to do that to my children. And some of them had parents who told them, you are not going to farm. You're going to find something else to do because this is too hard. And so the proportion of very young farmers shrank down tremendously during the 1980s. And so there's been this demographic shift. And Iowa farmers were already old. Now they're really old. It's going to be interesting. I've already talked about the last generation farmers. It's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in the next 20 years or so, because the number of farmers has shrunk considerably. They've aged considerably. It's just a completely different landscape out there. And there's, well, I think it's entirely up to grabs what Iowa agriculture is going to look like, at least in terms of who's doing the farming, 10, 20 years out.
You know, thinking about maybe the legacy and impact of this, you know, this work, I'm curious, what should listeners of the pod take away from the crisis of the late 70s and 1980s? And you know, what sort of questions should we be asking about Midwestern history going forward?
What I hope people will do is understand that when decisions are made in Washington, the ripples in farm country often look very different than the ripples in other places. And that even though farmers are now, 1.8% of our population, that you have to pay attention, not just to urban areas, but to rural areas, and not just either coast, but also, you know, the middle of the country, which is much more dependent on agriculture economically than the rest of the country is. I hope they'll think that about ripples. I hope they'll also think about all of those individual stories, and that this was something that was created in many ways by Washington, but was felt by families, by children, by grandparents, that this was something that had a devastating effect because people didn't think. And when they thought about it a little bit, they didn't care. And that if we're going to make policy, then that policy needs to be made with care. What this tells us about Midwestern history, the things that happen in the middle of the country matter deeply. And there's so many more stories to be told. I mean, I did Iowa. And, you know, I think Iowa works great for telling this story. But I think the Minnesota story definitely needs to be told, because a lot of what Iowa did, they did mirroring what had been done in Minnesota when it came to aiding farmers. There's just so many more stories to be told. And I don't want anybody to think just because I wrote a book on the farm crisis that there aren't many more books that could be written about what happened during that period from, you know, the end of World War II right on up to, 2000.
Well, there's a charge for everybody, I guess, right?
Yep.
I'm just in total awe of the book. The writing in this book really does make you care.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. It was really hard for me to write because, you know, people are still alive who went mm-hmm. through this, and it's always very intimidating to pick up something that was so deeply felt by people who are still with us. And so that was kind of hard, but exciting.
Have you gotten any, have people contacted you since the book has come out to talk about the way you've written about this?
I have gotten emails from various people saying, thank you so much. I wanted someone to tell this story. Thank you for telling it. I've also spoken on this a fair number of times, and there's always people in the back row crying because they went through this and they are still, you know, still feeling the repercussions. It's for them something that's that's still alive and still a part of who they are. And so I just sort of expect that if I'm talking about this, that there are going to be people who are, visibly upset listening to it. But they always tell me, thank you for writing this. But, you know, I know I'm going to be digging up, you know, pulling off Band-Aids and digging up things that they'd sometimes rather forget.
We also appreciate you sharing this research and discussing this with us.
Well, thank you for asking me. This was fun.
Thank you.